Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
I led the charge on getting more money for capacity building in Mexico, something nobody really wants to say. They don't want to say that our government is paying to help build capacity in Mexico so we can enforce trade agreements. I'll say that because I believe in trade.
Senator Maria Cantwell from Washington, member of the Finance Committee.
So I'm just trying to understand this notion that somehow trade agreements are 20th century tools and that they're some sort of recluse of something we're not going to do anymore, and that the Indo-Pacific Agreement will not have a mechanism that's specifically focused on opening up markets. So my people believe, the people in the state of Washington doing business, growing crops, want to know always, what are we doing to increase market access? That's what they want to know.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm disappointed about negotiations and congressional consultation, but I also have concerns about enforcement.
Idaho Senator Mike Crapo is the ranking member on the Senate Finance Committee addressing Ambassador Catherine Tai.
Americans need to compete on a level playing field, and I appreciate the administration's prosecution of two USMCA labor disputes under the Brown-Wyden mechanism, yet much more can be done. With respect to the USMCA, agricultural market challenges remain. Mexico continues to restrict potatoes and delay approval of biotech crops. Discriminatory practices targeting our technology companies are also increasing. Rather than launch cases, the administration appears to be in retreat. For example, the trade agenda highlights that USTR reached agreements to terminate our Section 301 investigations against various countries over discriminatory digital service taxes. Let's be very clear about what this means. Those countries are going to continue imposing discriminatory taxes on U.S. firms. They may give a credit one day, but only if Congress approves the Biden administration's international tax deal. The Biden administration is blessing foreign governments which discriminate against Americans as long as Congress refuses to go along with its plan to cede taxing rights and revenue to foreign competitors. Let me close with where I started. Past being prologue. History proves that Americans do not fear competition, but rise to it. And now is the time to seize on that history and go further on trade, not shrink from it.
However, in her opening statement, Ambassador Tai...
President Biden believes that trade can be a force for good, that grows the middle class and addresses inequality. And he believes we are at our strongest when we work with others around the world. Over the last year, in coordination with my colleagues across the Biden administration, we have worked to repair strained relationships and recommitted the United States to the world's institutions. These partnerships have led to the united response to Russia's unjustified attack on Ukraine. Turning specifically to our work at USTR, our agenda begins with putting workers at the center of our trade policy. When we defend the rights of workers at home and abroad, labor standards go up and we drive that race to the top. Farmers, ranchers, fishers, and food manufacturers are key to our trade agenda, and we have delivered real, economically meaningful wins for them. The 232 tariff arrangements and large civil aircraft frameworks with the EU and UK lifted retaliatory tariffs on billions of dollars of U.S. agricultural exports. The agreement with Japan will allow our exporters to meet Japan's growing beef demand. We regained access to the EU for our shellfish industry, and we've opened access for U.S. pork exports to India. We are also realigning the U.S.-China trade relationship. We launched a conversation with the PRC about its Phase 1 purchase commitment shortfalls and broader non-market practices. Those discussions have been unduly difficult, and it is time for us to turn the page on the old playbook. That starts with developing new domestic tools and making strategic investments to maintain our global competitive edge. We have made progress on this effort through the American Rescue Plan, the administration's focus on supply chain resilience, and the bipartisan infrastructure law. Passing the Bipartisan Innovation Act will build on this significant progress.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The situation in Ukraine is very fluid and fast-moving, making it difficult to present any firm judgments about what will happen, such that I'm going to as much raise questions as much as answer them.
Dr. William Liefert is a private consultant retired from the Economic Research Service at a recent Farm Foundation forum.
Also, my sense is that in the short run, and maybe for the entire year, war, geopolitics, and policy will dominate commercial and economic factors in determining what happens to Ukraine's grain economy and exports. The two key questions, I think, for grain appear to be, will Ukraine be able to export its remaining supplies from last autumn's grain harvest? That's a short one question. And then, how will the invasion disrupt the new grain crop season?
So one question might be, how could this affect shipping in the future?
If Ukraine gains control of the entire Black Sea coast, it'll have a stranglehold on the country's foreign trade and thereby have strong leverage on the rest of the Ukrainian economy. Russia will also control Ukraine's grain trade because over 90% of Ukraine's grain exports are shipped out of Black Sea ports. And as I mentioned, most of the west rather than east of the Crimea, just as a vast bulk of Russia's wheat or grain exports come out of the Black Sea. Other impediments to Ukraine's grain exports are the destruction of physical and port infrastructure, including even some silos, and that shipping might be reluctant to operate in the Black Sea because of high insurance premia and all the other uncertainty.
What effects could the invasion have on Russia's economy and exports?
This discussion is a bit easier than for Ukraine because Russia is not a battlefield. However, Russia's economy is being hit very hard by the severe economic sanctions that the U.S. and other Western countries have imposed. And these sanctions have the goal of cutting Ukraine or Russia off from the international financial system and world trade. And here are some of the negative effects of those shocks. The Russian currency, the ruble, has depreciated by about 18% since the invasion began. The Russian stock market has crashed. I read it's crashed by about 80%, crashed right away within days, and it's been closed for about 3 weeks. There's been major capital flight, Western business flight, and some human capital flight out of Russia. The human capital flight results because, you know, some educated and skilled people opposed to the invasion are leaving the country. The expected consequences of all these shocks are both deep recession, maybe even a depression, and high inflation. Dual macro problems which put policymakers on the horns of a dilemma, because if policy combats one of these problems, it can exacerbate the other. A survey of economists conducted by the Russian Central Bank predicts the Russian GDP could fall in 2022 by 8% compared to 4.7% growth in 2021. High inflation will result largely from the ruble depreciation and other sanctions-induced disruptions to the economy. The same survey predicts that inflation in 2020 will be 20% compared to 5.9% in 2021. In the longer term, if the conflict continues, the financial and human capital flight and being cut off from Western investment and business partnerships will not bode well for Russian technological progress and productivity growth and agriculture, as well as the overall economy.
Dr. William Liefert from a recent Farm Foundation forum. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The other part, you know, I said we need to get those immunoglobulins in, but the colostrum also helps stave off dehydration.
Jamie Lynn Farney is a beef system specialist at Kansas State.
Quality colostrum. Ideally, if you can get high-quality colostrum from cows within your own herd, it is the best thing because your cows are exposed to the bacteria, virus, the environmental conditions that those calves are going to be exposed to. So that is the best quality of colostrum to help protect those calves. From that dam is really good if you can get her milked out. Sometimes you can't. You don't want to use colostrum from really thin cows. Cows that are in body condition score 4 or less, we know have lower immunoglobulin levels.
So when you're looking to find a colostrum on your farm, good conditioned cow who's not actively sick and has been appropriately vaccinated, that's who you use. You could use colostrum replacer, which is another good alternative, not the colostrum supplement. So you can see the two bags out there when you go shopping, but they are different. The replacer, as the name says, is what you can do if you have no colostrum. The supplement, in theory, is supposed to help boost whatever colostrum you have. However, the research shows that the supplement is not been actually beneficial and leads to more negatives because of a dilution of the quality ingredients you want, because those calves do like to drink that supplement. So you have colostrum and calories. So those kind of go in, you know, back to back. Cleanliness. As you know, pathogen loads and you know, the calf scours and bacterial scours with bottle baited calves are very, very common. And luckily, that is something that we can manage for. That's where it takes a little bit of time and commitment. Clean and disinfect your feeding instruments. That is the bottom line. Clean and disinfect your feeding instruments. Warm water. Go ahead and clean with a soap. Rinse them. And they do make some calf bottle disinfectants. You can go ahead and do a quick rinse with those and keep them dry. You know, you can paper towel dry them if you need to use them immediately, but make sure you store them somewhere where they can have airflow and air dry. So those are some really important components to keep them clean from the bottle side. Keep your calf environment clean. Put down good, nice straw. Remove the fecal matter as much as possible. If you have multiple calves in one area, if one of them is starting to get sick, segregate it from the others. Those are just some cleanliness, biosecurity type of things you need to worry about. And the hay kind of goes into my fourth C of comfort. The happier you keep those calves, the more consumption they get, more calories. All of these just dovetail into each other.
She has one more C.
You think about these calves, you can't feed them two bottles one day, three bottles the next day, feed them every 10 hours one day. And just like when we're feeding finishing calves, the more consistent you can keep your feeding time, the better for their digestive system.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Mexico is a key partner in the USMCA, and it sure looks to me like they are slamming the brakes on renewable energy reform.
Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee from Oregon, Ron Wyden, addressing Ambassador Catherine Tai with USTR.
In recent years, Mexico made substantial efforts to modernize and green the electricity market. They gave the green light to foreign investment, and they opened their market, particularly to innovative American providers of renewable electricity. But as I just indicated, now it looks like they're in retreat. You know, they're considering laws that concentrate market power and regulatory authority in the hands of the state-owned electric company. That result will mean a bigger focus on fossil fuels with limited opportunities for clean energy providers. So Mexico's new reforms are a 1-2 punch against environmental progress in America. Not only are they a setback in the fight against the climate crisis, but they are denying American companies, companies in the Pacific Northwest, for example, a fair shake in the Mexican market. And my view is what Mexico is doing now looks to me like it's running opposite from the promises Mexico made in the USMCA. So, Ambassador, as we've talked about, the United States needs to make sure that every chapter of USMCA is fully implemented and pays off for American workers and businesses and a cleaner climate in the Americas. That's what was pursued in USMCA. What are you doing to address Mexico's actions in the energy market that I've described?
Chairman Wyden, thank you for asking this very, very important question. Let me begin by affirming my agreement with you and my commitment that the USMCA must be enforced and implemented across all of its chapters. And we will be, that is an organizing principle of our work. I am also deeply concerned with the legislative and regulatory developments in the Mexican energy industry that we have seen in recent months. My team and I at USTR, along with much of the U.S. government, have expressed these concerns regularly and directly to our counterparts in the Mexican government. Just last week, I convened a roundtable with members of Congress, with members from our environmental organization community, from our energy industry that includes renewable energy companies as well as our more traditional energy companies. And the testimony I heard from them was powerful. They have been unified in expressing concerns with what is happening in Mexico, specifically with respect to the competitiveness of the North American energy market, as well as the competitiveness of Mexico's own energy industry. I have informed Mexico, and I assure you that we at USTR are looking at all available options under the USMCA to address these issues so that the USMCA can work for our stakeholders and protect our environment across all three countries.
Well, we'll want to work very closely with you because it seems to me that, you know, Mexico on one area after another as it relates to greener energy and the challenge of environmental reform is walking back what they pledged in USMCA, and we can't sit by and abide that.
Exchange at the recent Senate Finance Committee hearing on trade. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
You know our mission. We're here to help the department deliver its programs as effectively as possible. And ultimately, you also know that we do not have the authority to implement our own recommendations. We depend on USDA officials to take necessary corrective actions.
USDA Inspector General Phyllis Fong testifying recently before the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Ag.
For much of the past 2 years, we have been working in a maximum telework setting. And I have to say, I am extremely proud of our dedicated staff. They have demonstrated flexibility and innovation. They've produced outstanding oversight work. As you all know, we've issued 33 audit products this past year. We obtained 228 convictions in criminal matters, and we reported over $686 million in results for FY21, all of which demonstrates the dedication of our staff. As we move forward in FY22, we have a number of challenges in our oversight portfolio. We will continue to finish our work and start other work with respect to several major funding streams that some of you have alluded to. We are finishing our work on all of the disaster assistance programs that were funded in the wake of the hurricanes in 2017. We have much ongoing work with respect to pandemic funds. Billions and billions of dollars went to the department for pandemic relief, and we have to provide appropriate oversight of that. And as you also allude to, the infrastructure investments that Congress passed this past November, we do have oversight responsibilities for all of those programs as well. This is in addition to our normal portfolio of statutory mandates, financial statement audits, improper payments, IT security, and other requirements, as well as our ongoing responsibilities to provide a level of oversight to all of USDA's programs and agencies. So we believe that our hands are full. And to handle this increased workload, we will need all the resources that you have appropriated for us in FY22, as well as the increase that's been proposed in the President's FY23 request. We will also have to work smarter on our own part. We're going to need to develop additional tools and approaches. And to that end, we are looking to our data analytics staff as we hone our ability to understand data, develop new approaches and products, and identify potential areas for our audit and investigative work. This is all in addition to our traditional tools of audit products, criminal investigations, and partnerships with other IG offices as we identify and address trends and cross-cutting issues. As you mentioned, my full statement is in the record. It describes many of the reports we issued last year. So I'll just close again by thanking all of you and asking for your continued support as we move through the process, the appropriation process for FY23. The president's request would provide $112 million for OIG in 23, which is an increase of about $5.7 million, which would allow us in particular to provide more oversight of the infrastructure investments in NRCS, RUS, and NIFA, among other priorities.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You've indicated, and Senator Wyden pointed out, that on the environmental and labor front, you are actively pursuing efforts to try to enforce the agreement. But I see no activity to try to enforce the market access parts of the agreement. And let me focus my question specifically on potatoes.
Recent interaction between Senator Mike Crapo from Idaho and U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai.
I think it's a little over a year ago now, both you and I were in Mexico, and both you and I raised the potato issue. And both you and I got, you know, a response from the Mexican government that they were going to resolve it. The Mexican Supreme Court even is ruling in our favor on this issue. Yet I don't see any enforcement action against Mexico on USMCA with regard to potato access. Could you respond to that?
Mr. Crapo, I know how important the potatoes are to you, and you know how much I love potatoes. with respect to USMCA enforcement, again, let me reiterate my commitment to enforcing all aspects. And on market access, I want to also raise the dairy case that we have prosecuted.
Exactly.
Again. On potatoes in particular, I just spoke to USDA Secretary Vilsack last night about this issue. We have not given up hope, even though we have been taking two steps forward and one step backward for many months now. I just want to let you know how high on our radar this is and how focused we are on trying to secure a win here, and to let you know that all options are on the table if we are not able to secure that win.
Crapo also wants to know what's happening with China.
In your opening statement, you report that China failed to live up to its phase one agreement. It's easier for the public to see China's unfulfilled purchase of commitments, but it is much harder for anyone to know where China fell short on these structural commitments. Why doesn't the USTR provide this committee with its assessment on which obligations China failed to comply? And how do you plan to redress China's failure to meet these commitments?
Well, Ranking Member Crapo, you're right. In terms of the purchase commitments, those are the most transparent because everybody has access to the trade data. I would be happy to engage with you beyond the public statements that I have already made with respect to our assessment of China's performance under the Phase 1 agreement. One point I would like to make, however, is that with respect to the commitments that China signed up for, there are a number of different kinds. Obviously, there are the purchase commitments. There are commitments on laws and regulations that China had to pass. And then over time, especially with respect to the intellectual property and forced tech transfer commitments, China's compliance is going to need to be measured by the experience of our own industries who are seeking to do business in China. So it is a dynamic picture, but I am all for having that conversation with you and others, and believe that we have been having that conversation as well.
The concern's bipartisan. As Maria Cantwell, a Democrat from Washington, added,
I don't find where we are, and we had a conversation with you, a roundtable discussion with our members, and you said, well, we're trying to reset the table here with China. So we gave you more time. And now we're here, and we're hearing this focus that we're not saying that opening market access and getting rid of tariffs is a priority. And that's what the people in my state want to hear. As a very trade-dependent state, they want to know that we are fighting to increase market access. When you think about wheat, when you think about potatoes, when you think about some of these other products, it's more than 70% of the product. It's an export market. And when you look at the impacts of the 301 tariffs and how bad apples have been hurt, we want resolution to these issues. I mean, we are not even getting the exclusion at this point. So it's very hard to look at this equation, and this isn't specific to the Biden administration. I didn't agree with the last administration's approach on this.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Enforcement is key to trade policy delivering on its promises. We have used the USMCA rapid response mechanism twice to defend workers' rights in Mexico, which helps workers here by driving a race to the top. We pursued dispute settlement with Canada to ensure that U.S. dairy farmers are treated fairly. We also initiated environmental consultations with Mexico to prevent unreported and unregulated fishing.
Testifying last week before the Senate Finance Committee, Ambassador Catherine Tai with the USTR.
A final important part of our trade agenda is promoting trade policy that is equitable, inclusive, and durable. And the President's trade agenda includes objectives to advance racial and gender equity. We will continue to pair these values with sustained stakeholder engagement.